Hello, and welcome to the second episode of the UAC's Graduate Forum podcast series. This new concept intends to highlight the research and insights of our network of postgraduate and early career researchers in contemporary European studies. Inspired by the theme of our 2023 Graduate Forum research conference held in Barcelona, Rebuilding Europe After a Decade in Crisis, we are joined today by Scott Arthurson, a doctoral student and politics tutor at the University of Melbourne. Based in the School of Social and Political Sciences, Scott's discussion will focus on how intellectuals use the concept of populism. Welcome, Scott.
Oh, hi, Hazel. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
So, as I've said, this podcast is inspired by research you presented at UAC's Graduate Forum Research Conference in June 2023. In your presentation, you discussed populism and its definitional dilemmas. One of the angles you explored was populism as an analytical category. For those of us who missed your presentation, could you tell us a bit more about this perspective?
Yeah, of course, I'd love to. So I borrow this term, the analytical category, from Peter Worsley. So I mean that populism is mostly a category applied by intellectuals to divide up, to categorize, and to make sense of the world. So it's something used to talk about and analyze other people. It's rarely used as a rallying cry or a term of self-identification. So these days, it's rare to find anyone claiming to be a populist or calling for more populism, for example, especially in Europe. When they do, they're often reacting to other people calling them a populist or criticizing mainstream rhetoric about populism. So the term's also not very grounded in historical examples. So there was once a party in the United States in the 1890s who called themselves the populists, which is where the term comes from. But most scholars of populism barely mention them. Instead, populism is used to compare various recent parties and politicians, and even when they have very different goals and methods. So this makes it really different from other contested political concepts like democracy, socialism, liberalism, freedom, equality, conservatism, and so on. While people argue over what these words mean, the argument's often more grounded either in movements that lay claim to those concepts, like, oh, we're the socialists, we're the liberals, or in concrete historical examples. In contrast, populism is kind of a catch-all label to identify sort of a political illness or pathology. So there's a number of scholars that noted these problems pretty early on. You had Peter Worsley in 1969 or Margaret Canavan in 1981. And as they said, there's never been a populist international. Populism is not an identity, a rallying cry, or even a brute fact about the world. It's something we project onto the world. And so it's very open to interpretation. That's what Peter Worsley meant when he called it a purely analytical category. And similarly, Canavan points out that the meaning of populism fluctuates depending on who's interpreting it, which is mostly intellectuals, academics, journalists, maybe policy elites. So even if the concept of populism turns out to be a useful analytical category, has powerful rhetorical effects, and it shapes how we think about various political divides in Europe today, such as the tensions between the EU and popular democracy. So it's often used to posit a lot of different political actors in that context as an other, as a threat to the existing order. Does that help answer your question?
Yes, definitely. Thank you. So moving on, part of your research paper outlines how narrow definitions of populism can be problematic. Can you detail why this is?
Yeah, of course, that's a really good question, in fact. The concept of populism has been applied to a lot of different political actors, and it's accumulated a lot of different connotations. It's been applied to third world anti-imperial movements, to McCarthyism, popular politics and economic policy in Latin America, Margaret Thatcher, the Nazism, communism, a radical right parties in Europe since the 80s, and also anti-austerity left politics like Occupy Wall Street, Theresa, Bernie Sanders, Podemos. On the other hand, it's been defined as a political strategy manipulating the masses to gain power, as the ideology of the middle class, as a counter-hegemonic discourse, as a liberal democracy, as a thin ideology counterposing a virtuous people to a bad elite, and so on and so on. There's just so many. So one logical response to this chaos is to narrow down the term's connotations. So you arrive at a more narrow definition that accommodates all the different cases. This is what you'd call a minimal definition. Now, on the upside, you do get a definition that fits the cases or seems to, but there's problems. First, you might come to something so narrow that it doesn't really say much. And the only thing shared by almost all things called populism, in my view, is that it's some kind of appeal to the popular as a source of value or legitimacy. But this applies to most democratic politics. Yet strangely, we don't call it all populist. That brings us to the second problem. Things in common between the cases may not be the real reason they bear the same label. Supposing we define populism as any popular appeal against an elite. Now, someone might label something populist partly due to other connotations they associate with the term. For example, that it's dangerous, anti-pluralist, threatening to some particular political project. Even if they can justify the labeling on the basis of the official definition, these other connotations might be playing into why they're labeling it. And even worse, the reason may actually lie outside of the populists themselves. For example, they might all have a similar relationship to the interpreter. For instance, there might be a relationship of, mutual hostility between the groups, and that might be part of why one group calls another group a certain way, out of antagonism, not out of anything that's in common between them necessarily. On the other hand, you could define populism by including more necessary connotations. So you include more connotations and capture all of that, but you narrow down the cases it applies to. So this is a different kind of narrowing. So you might say, like the scholar Jan Vernon Muller does, that appealing to the people against an elite is not enough to constitute populism. And rather, you'd say populism entails a claim to exclusively represent the people while really only standing for a fraction of them. In that case, that's not just anti-elitist or popular appeal, but that's anti-pluralist, anti-democratic, and kind of deceptive. So any so-called populists who don't meet that definition, what Muller would say, well, they're not really populists at all. This definition is very clever, but this creates new problems. At first, it can be pretty arbitrary and at odds with normal usage. So like Muller is pretty vague in some of his work about whether the original US populists are populists at all, or even the status of a number of left-wing populists that a lot of people call populists. And you see this problem even more with another famous scholar, Kurt Whelan's definition, which excludes some of the most famous cases of populism in Europe from the definition. And, you know, further, these such definitions tend to reinforce some very specific connotations, which in practice get ascribed to anyone people commonly think of as a populist. So either way, you aren't capturing the real usage of the term. You either suppress important connotations, which nonetheless persist in how people think of populism, or you cut off important cases of populism, which people will keep calling populism anyway.
You make really interesting points there. So building upon this, can you explain why research about populism matters?
In short, because it filters our understanding of democracy and popular politics, and it directs our inquiries in these areas and our understanding. So when it comes to the more narrow definitions of populism we're talking about here, well, narrow definitions are a way of simplifying the world and imposing a particular ideological perspective. If our goal is clarification and understanding of a term's real usage, it makes more sense to me to map the various ways it's used rather than drawing strict boundaries around its meaning. This mapping would also provide resources for critique. But once we understand how a term's really used, we're in a better position to assess this usage, its effects, and how we might prefer to define it if we do want to enter into that ideological fray. In my case, I propose a definition of populism which has a very broad criterion for which all cases of populism have in common, but I combine this with an open text criterion relating to how intellectuals fill out the meaning of the term in accordance with their own values and priorities.
At the Graduate Forum conference in June, you discussed your research on a panel with two other academics with different specialisms. Did you find presenting your research in this environment particularly useful? And were there any insights from the other PhD researchers interesting to you and your research?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought the other panelists' papers were really fascinating. And well, while they were looking at very different subject matter, they crossed over with mine in some interesting and unexpected ways. So for example, one paper on abortion laws and women's rights in Poland, for instance, ended up addressing issues with contested concepts, including democracy. And that's something pretty central to my own work. So those sorts of crossovers, I'd say they're eye-opening really as to how certain problems I need to unpack in my own work aren't unique to it, but they occur in different ways in different contexts. And above all, I'd say it was great to have a chance to discuss our work afterwards, share our thoughts and ideas, and share some quite specific feedback on the papers themselves. I think having read each other's papers was really helpful for that.
And you came quite a long way to the event in Barcelona, as you're based at the University of Melbourne in Australia. So how did you find out about our Graduate Forum Research Conference, and did you find it useful for networking?
Yeah. So I was searching online for conferences in Europe relevant to my studies. I wanted to get over to Europe in any case, partly to meet more academics in my field and spend some more time in European context, since my focus for parts of my thesis. And well, the OASIS conference was one of two conferences I attended this trip. And I also took the opportunity to do some further traveling and see some people I know. And well, yeah, it's always good to meet some people in your field. Part of it is making professional contacts and meet future collaborators, what people, I guess, call networking. What I value most is the chance for intellectual discussions and relationships with people interested in similar questions, topics, ideas, politics. And I think that really helps to challenge, refine, and reshape your ideas and how you express them. Also, to bring them back to a shared frame of reference, which, you can be down your rabbit hole a little bit as a grad student. So ultimately, if we're studying politics or European studies, we want our ideas to connect to real issues. And I think dialogue helps us to do this. So yeah, I met some lovely people. I learned a lot and I had some great discussions. And I really hope to stay in touch with some of the other researchers I met there.
Thank you so much, Scott, for telling us more about your research and the conference. And it was a pleasure to meet you.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you so much, Hazel.
And this concludes the second episode of the UAC's Graduate Forum podcast series. Keep an eye on our social media accounts for upcoming content and see you all next episode.